and mouth, and breathe deeply through the nose. But the plastic quickly fills it, and I again open my mouth to complete the breath, but the plastic is there as well, and I force it away with my tongue, drawing in more air, all that I will need, I tell to myself, holding it in, my chest weakened by its fullness. I feel Nadi's shoulder pressed to mine, and I regret not having played music on her new player. I have a sharp desire to hear it, the poetry of Dashtistani, the neigh and dombak, the beckoning music of home. I release my breath, its sound a wind in my ears, the plastic slipping from my nose and mouth, but then returning with the insistence of the sea, covering all the sand prints left behind, filling all the holes and channels. I attempt to force the plastic out once more, just once more, but the ocean is rising with the moon, its pressure growing in my chest, my heart and lungs beginning to burst beneath the weight of an unseen hand, my body struggling as it sinks into the bed. The plastic becomes iron against my face, and my arms float weightlessly as I attempt to pull free the tape, but my fingers do not function correctly, fluttering uselessly against my throat and chin. I no longer have legs, and there is a terrible sound in my ears, the deafening pitch of low-flying F-16s, my chest beginning to fracture, my abdomen heaving, something beginning to open and release, a warmth filling me. Vodka and fire, the hot wind of a desert sky, the earth falling away beneath me. Lester's cell was a stainless steel sink and toilet, a steel writing desk, and two iron bunks recessed into the wall. Above each mattress was a small rectangular window, its bulletproof glass fogged so that all Lester could see was daylight, and the floor was 8 feet wide and 12 feet long, the ceiling 30 feet above him, three iron girders painted as white as everything else. Lester sat at the edge of the bottom bunk, both hands resting on his knees. His eyelids were heavy and burned slightly, and his mouth hung partly open with fatigue. He was too warm wearing both jail-issue shirts, and he lay back on his bunk, staring at the myriad of holes in the steel bedframe above him. At the Hall of Justice, he had sat without his shirt in a hardback chair and heard himself tell the truth about everything, his voice low and subdued as he kept seeing the boy spin, his arms hanging loose as rope, as he let go of the gun and landed on his side, one arm stretched out, almost pointing, the way toddlers do, to something they recognize but can't name. Someone had handed him a glass of water, and Lester drank it down all at once. In the small room were two deputies, two detectives, and Lieutenant Alvarez, standing with his back to the bright window, his face in shadow. The detectives were asking Lester about the Birani family, their imprisonment overnight, Lester pointing his service pistol at them, moving the son and father against their will to Redwood City. They asked him about Kathy. Was she at the Corona address right now, holding Mrs. Birani against her will? And Lester's voice sounded almost normal. No, she's waiting for us to get back, that's all. Lester looked down at his hands, imagined Mrs. Birani hearing her son had been shot. He imagined hearing his own son had been shot, how he would immediately picture the worst, little Nate's smooth face contorted and pale, as too much blood left his body too fast. Is the boy all right? One of the detectives said he was in surgery, and Lester turned his wedding ring twice on his finger. He'd washed his hands, but there was still dried blood in the tiny cracks of his palms. He thought of Kathy, her red Bonneville in the backyard when a patrol car got there. He looked up. "I'd like to call my wife." Lieutenant Alvarez was writing something on a pad of paper, and he stepped forward as quickly as if someone had just insulted him. "You'll get your two calls at intake, Burden." Lester had felt an impulse to look away, but didn't. Alvarez shook his head like even this eye contact, was way out of line. And he told two deputies to arrest him and take him across the street to the new holding facility. A short walk, usually, but now it was long. Lester as handcuffed and bare-chested as a wino, a deputy at each arm, his face down. Inside, they uncuffed him, and Lester gave them what they wanted, his wallet, car keys, and wedding ring. One of the arresting deputies told him to hold his arms out, and he gave Lester a pat search, his hands heavy and careful. The intake officer had broad shoulders, short red hair, and a small white scar on his chin. He sat behind glass and put Lester's keys and ring in a manila envelope, counted the cash in his wallet, then had Lester sign a form in two places, Lester thinking of Kathy being there when a patrol car pulled up, everything going as completely wrong as it could. He heard himself ask to make a call, but again his voice was subdued, muffled somehow. The intake officer looked right at Lester, but didn't answer him. Just dropped his personal possessions into a box Lester couldn't see. The deputies disappeared, and one from the holding facility took their place, a short Chicano with a neck as wide as his jaw. He escorted Lester to a part of the procedure he'd never had to stay around for, to a fluorescent-lit room with no windows, a Filipino woman there in a white lab coat. She was small and dark and pretty, her hair held back with a red and purple pelican barrette, and Lester wished he at least had his shirt on. She wore white protective gloves. She wiped alcohol on the inside of Lester's forearm, then pressed a round TB skin pop into it, pulling it away just as quickly. She told him to sit down, and she leaned against a counter covered with jars of cotton swabs, held a clipboard, and asked the Chicano jailhouse deputy Lester's name. Lester Victor Burdon. The deputy's accent was East Palo Alto Barrio. Now the pretty nurse was asking Lester questions of his medical history, his body since he was a boy, his sexual relations since he was a man. Had he ever tested positive for HIV? She looked at him then, directly in the face, and it left Lester feeling he had something to lie about when he didn't. He answered no, and then he was in the photo and fingerprints room, standing against the wall in front of the Eticon machine. The technician telling him to look straight ahead at the blinking green light, Lester feeling he was being X-rayed, that this computer graphic of his face, this jailhouse mugshot, was really him, the true Lester. The Chicano deputy called him over to the Identex and began rolling Lester's fingertips, one by one, onto the computer pad. It felt strange to have each finger guided like that, like someone was helping him to dress or feed himself. And as the Chicano officer finished, then escorted Lester down a bright corridor, Lester felt something was about to begin that wouldn't end for a long time. He knew the schedule for bail. He knew there wouldn't be any for kidnapping. That meant he'd be here until a hearing, and that could take months, sometimes over a year. He felt queasy, his mouth suddenly full of tacky saliva. He thought of Carol, saw her in the kitchen dicing onions at a counter. He imagined the kids, both of them drawing with crayons on the floor of Bethany's room, and again he saw the colonel's son drop heavily to the sidewalk, blood pulsing from two wounds, and he felt afraid. The deputy led him around a corner and opened a door for him. It was a small room with a desk and telephone, its white cinder block walls freshly painted. "Two calls in the county, Burdon. 5 minutes." The door was reinforced glass, and the Chicano officer stood on the other side, his arms folded, glancing in at Lester every few seconds. Lester picked up the receiver, but didn't know the colonel's number. He dialed information, hoping that wouldn't count as one of his two calls. Then he was ringing the Berani residence, a brand new listing. His throat felt thick and dry. The phone began to ring, and he remembered Kathy as he'd left her, standing in the hallway of her stolen house in shorts and a Fisherman's Wharf t-shirt, her hair slightly unkempt around her face he'd kissed before leaving. By tonight, he'd imagined the two of them driving north in a rented car, maybe giddy for having just gotten away by a hair. Now he just wanted to hear her voice, a bit husky and unsure of itself. He just wanted to hear her say his name. But the phone kept ringing, and no one was picking it up. A patrol car might have gotten there already, but he didn't think so. Maybe Kathy and the colonel's wife weren't in the house, but outside. He pictured them sitting up on that new widow's walk, waiting. The deputy tapped on the glass and pointed at his watch. Lester let the phone ring 4 more times, then hung up. He hadn't expected Kathy not to answer, and now he felt as cut off from things as he could imagine. For a second, it was as if she had never existed and wasn't real at all. What they had started together was an illusion, just a lovely rug thrown over a hole in the floor, and now the rug was gone, and Lester was falling into something that had been there all along, and she had only come into his life to lead him to it. Cold spread through his bowels, and his face grew hot. He glanced at the deputy's dark profile, thought of Berani screaming in Farsi inside the patrol car, the veins coming out in his forehead and neck. Maybe he'd called his wife from the hospital, and Kathy had taken a chance with the Bonneville and driven his wife there. That's just what she would do. Lester dialed information again and was going to ask for the hospital's main number when the deputy walked in and pressed the hang-up button. 2 calls. 2 were information. I didn't know the numbers. The deputy took the receiver, hung it up, and motioned for Lester to step back into the corridor. Lester felt a tightening heat deep in his middle, and he wanted to hit the deputy in the mouth.
Let's go, Berdon.
It's Berdon. Deputy Sheriff Berdon. The Chicano smiled, blinking his eyes as lazily as a lizard's.
You want to keep that to yourself around here, FTO. Now move.
Lester walked with the deputy back down the corridor, his breathing shallow, the cinder block walls a glossed eggshell white, not a blemish anywhere, no scuff marks or chipped holes from a leg iron, no graffiti, no dried spit and blood, a brand new facility. He began to feel that edge again, all of his tissues clear and ready, his stomach a low fire. Then he was in a small room with 4 or 5 others, arrestees, all waiting for dress down. The deputy told Lester to have a seat among a single row of steel chairs welded into 2 walls, facing each other. The Chicano handed Lester's paperwork to a desk deputy, then left without a word. Across from Lester sat a long black kid, his skin the color of flan, his short hair freshly cut, his initials or his girlfriend's shaved into his head. He wore a tank top, oversized jeans, and white Converse All-Stars untied. He kept picking at his nails, 3 gold rings on the fingers of his right hand, 2 on the left. The others were young, too, an Asian and a white kid who seemed to know each other, the white kid whispering to the Asian about a dead boy named Beef. The Asian leaning his head back against the wall, his eyes half closed in a waking nap, a small blue serpent etched beneath the corner of his left eye like a tear. Lester glanced at the man beside him. He was sitting sideways in his chair, his wide back hunched to the others, his hair dark and matted, and when he saw Lester, he looked away quickly, and Lester did too, a gush of heat letting go inside him. The man was Filipino, a small-deal bookmaker out of Daly City, and Lester couldn't remember how or when their paths had crossed.
For a moment, he kept his face down. But then he thought he might appear weak, so he raised his chin up again and sat back straight in the chair, his heartbeats lost somewhere inside his tongue. The door opened and a jailhouse deputy called in the bookie, a name Lester didn't know, and he smelled him as he passed by. Piss and sweat and cigarette smoke in old denim. The door shut behind him, and now the Asian kid was looking right at Lester, his eyes dark slits, his head still against the wall, his arms crossed in front of his chest. The white kid stopped talking and looked too, taking in Lester from his running shoes and bare chest to his face.
"You looking for something?" Lester said.
The white kid shrugged and glanced at his friend. The Asian stared at Lester a few seconds longer, then smiled and turned his head away slightly, closing his eyes and leaving the smile on his face. The other kid looked at Lester one more time, then at a spot on the wall just to his right, and Lester glanced at the desk deputy, a lean man in his 50s, eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich on white bread, reading the San Francisco Chronicle. The Asian looked asleep, his eyes closed, his legs stretched out in front of him, but his lips were still fixed in that smile he'd given Lester, and Lester didn't like seeing it now. It was as if the kid had looked and seen the trajectory of Lester's entire life and was now gratified it had all come down to this. The door opened again, and the white kid stood, but the dressed-down deputy called in Lester, pronouncing his name perfectly, and soon the clothes Lester had yanked from his suitcase this morning at the fish camp were gone, and he was pulling on orange jailhouse skivvies, orange canvas pants, an orange t-shirt, and a canvas button-down shirt with County Jail embossed in black letters on the back. For his feet, he wore orange socks under orange rubber shower sandals, and they clicked softly against each heel as he walked with a new deputy down a brightly lit corridor to central holding. The deputy was short and smelled of Old Spice cologne. It was what Lester's father used to wear, and the deputy was chewing gum as they walked, reading through Lester's paperwork.
"An FTO? What happened, man?"
He lowered the jacket to his side and picked up his pace. He didn't look at Lester, just kept his eyes straight ahead, waiting for an answer. Without judgment, it seemed, like they were two old friends running together, talking out a problem. Lester's legs felt heavy and stiff, and he began to breathe harder, the jailhouse sandals slapping his heels like a reproach. They reached a wide steel door at the end of the hall, and the deputy pulled from his pocket an ID card attached with a clear plastic cord to his belt. He inserted the card into a slit in the wall, then opened the door for Lester, and they stepped into a cavernous room with three tiers of closed-door cells, the fluorescent-lit ceiling over 100 feet above. In the center of the floor was a rounded desk with two officers on duty, and in the corner of the second tier was a one-way mirrored control booth. The air smelled of fresh paint and new air conditioning, and Lester could hear the buzz of half a dozen radios in the cells above. Each cell door had a small window in its center, and in one on the second tier was a man's face, a strand of white hair hanging over his eyes. Lester followed the deputy to the desk, where one officer was on the phone and the other was checking off names on a headcount sheet. The escort deputy dropped Lester's paperwork on the desk.
"When's the last time you guys had an FTO in protective?"
The deputy on the phone stopped talking, looked up at Lester, then glanced through his jacket. He shook his head once, pushed the papers over to his partner, then hung up the phone and gave Lester his full attention, squinting his eyes like he wanted to pose a question but wasn't quite sure how to start.
"I haven't gotten through to my lawyer or wife yet," Lester said. There was a dull metallic bang from one of the upper tiers.
"You didn't get your two calls?"
No one answered.
"Last meal's at 4. We'll get you to a phone after that."
"Home sweet home."
The escort deputy knocked once on the desk, then smiled and left,
the electronically locked door closing behind him with barely a sound. Now Lester lay back on his bunk. He could hear the faint bass note of another prisoner's radio, but nothing else. It was locked down, and the walls were thick. All was quiet and white. He was hungry, and he had no idea of the time, but he knew at 4 they'd bring him food, and then he could make his call. It would have to be Carol, of course. He'd explain to her what he could, that one thing had just led to another, that he hadn't quite been himself lately, and now things were upside down and inside out. But none of that was true. He couldn't remember the last time he'd felt more alive, more like who he might really be than in the last few days. Making love with Kathy on the ground at the Purissima, coming inside her beautiful mouth, even sticking his pistol up under the colonel's chin. But he would tell Carol none of this. He would ask her to call their divorce lawyer, ask him to hold off on their dissolution papers long enough to suggest a criminal attorney. A criminal lawyer. Les would ask to speak with Nate and Bethany, and he'd tell his daughter he'd see her at visiting hours and explain everything. That he was in this place because he did something wrong, and people were right to keep him here for now. He imagined her face, more his than Carol's, her dark eyes filling up right then, and he'd say, "No, no, it's all right. Everything's going to be all right." Lester closed his eyes, felt sleep waiting for him there behind his eyelids and in his limbs, a heavy, dark warmth, and he opened them again. He knew the shooting of the colonel's son would add a decade or more to any conviction, and even if he was found guilty of lesser charges, his life in law enforcement was over. He wanted to see Kathy. The patrol cars would be at her place in Corona now. More men in French blue moving in on her, escorting her from her house, most likely charging her with everything they were giving him. But she hadn't answered, so maybe she'd left already. Maybe she'd dropped Mrs. Berani off at the hospital and just kept driving. But he hoped that wasn't true. He hoped, at the very least, she was waiting for him somewhere. He wanted to see her right now. He wanted to stretch out beside her and rest his cheek on her bare breast, smell her smooth olive skin, hear the beating of her melancholy heart. He wanted to push himself all the way inside her and tell her not to worry. Don't worry about anything. Lester closed his eyes again, but when he did, he saw the colonel's son standing there in the sunlight, pointing the gun at him, his brown eyes moist with fear, one hand raised like he was getting ready to break and run, something Lester was certain the boy would have done if he'd known the truth, that the pistol was empty and useless. But Lester had denied him the truth to save himself. He had let fear have its way, and now he could only imagine that it had been otherwise, that the boy dropped the weapon and ran through the coffee crowd and away, his lean arms pumping, his thick black hair jerking slightly, people getting out of his way, Lester wrestling himself from the colonel, just to watch. Watch that one boy fly to some place better than this. And he thought again of the men who'd shot Ismail, practically boys themselves, letting their fear rule them as well. After what seemed a long while, Lester's body began to feel like part of the bunk. He was breathing deeply through his nose, and as sleep began to take him, he mouthed a prayer for Ismail, for his full recovery, and he saw himself holding and kissing Bethany and Nate. Then he was in a boat on some river, and Carol and Kathy were lying beside him, and there were thunderheads in the sky, but there was nothing to do about them. And so Lester closed his eyes, one arm beneath each woman. Something rumbled far off in the eastern sky. The air began to turn cool. He breathed in the smell of fish scales and perfume and damp wood. One of the women let out a whimper, as if in the middle of a bad dream. But Lester just settled deeper into the bottom of the boat and waited. Waited for the river to take them where it was going to anyway. To the inevitable conclusion of all he had done and failed to do. The air cooler now, almost cold, the boat beginning to rock.
The sky was black and turned to blue just before a ribbon of bright coral opened like a cut on the horizon. At the edge of the parking lot, on the other side of a tall wooden fence, were juniper trees planted in a yard. The grass was thick and short, and there was a sandbox and swing set and jungle gym all made from dark, beautiful wood. Redwood, or maybe cedar. The house was beige stucco with a sienna tile roof and a low, wide deck only a step off the ground, no railing, and four white plastic chairs around an umbrella table. Beside them, a child's plastic wading pool covered with smiling, spouting blue whales, and I watched from the other side of the fence, two stories up, each swallow a hook in the stitched belly of my throat. At 7, a male nurse brought me orange juice, coffee, and a bowl of soupy cream of wheat. But I didn't touch it, and not long after, the back door of the house opened, and a tiny brown-haired boy came running off the deck to the sandbox and blurred. I wiped my eyes. He put his hands in the sand, then lifted them over his head and let it sift down onto his hair. His mother set a mug of coffee or tea on the umbrella table, her long red hair catching the sunlight. She wore shorts and a loose t-shirt, and when she stepped off the deck and squatted at the sandbox, I could see her thigh muscles. She was laughing, frisking the sand out of her son's hair. Then she turned and went back to her coffee, sat at the umbrella table, and started to read. The little boy sat with his back to the fence and the hospital on the other side, his thick hair sticking out in curls behind his ears. I stared at the miniature blue and yellow striped shirt he wore, at his small bare arms and hands, at how big his head looked on his shoulders. Each swallow was thumbs crushing my Adam's apple all over again, and so I swallowed more than I needed. Pictured the toddler in the yard growing into a boy with blue jeans and a red bike, then a teenager with a skateboard or maybe a beat-up car, and I swallowed twice and finally saw him as a man. A tall young man with a wife and child of his own. He'd drive up to that house across the parking lot and visit his mother and father, but the image wouldn't stay, and instead I kept seeing Mrs. Birani's son, as I last saw him, climbing out of my car into the sunshine, glancing at Lester the way I'd seen high school boys wait for instruction from their coaches. The boy lifted a truck over his head, dropping it onto something metal I couldn't see. The mother glanced up at the sound, then went back to her newspaper, and the door behind me opened and the deputy sheriff stuck his head in, saw me sitting at the window in my hospital gown. He looked at me like he was trying to figure out what else I might be doing besides sitting. Then he closed the door. Yesterday, in another hospital, I woke to see Lester standing at the foot of the bed, my throat swollen and so dry it had cracked. His uniform was clean. His dark hair seemed too short, and he'd shaved his mustache, but I wanted him to come closer. I tried to speak, but a nurse put her fingers on my wrist and told me to stay quiet. She was old and slender. I looked back at Lester, but it wasn't him. This man was younger. His black hair was almost shaved, and his eyes were not brown, but blue. I tried to sit up, but the nurse put her hand on my shoulder, then showed me the button, and I pushed it, and the mattress raised me forward, and the nurse left the room. The deputy walked around to the side of my bed. There was another man in the chair behind him, older, with sandy hair and a tanned, lined face. He had a piece of paper in his hand, and he stood, introduced himself and the younger deputy, then opened it and read what I was being charged with: aggravated kidnapping, false imprisonment, brandishing a weapon. The young deputy leaned forward. My nose felt stopped up, but I could smell his aftershave. We know you're not able to talk right now, Mrs. Lazaro. Would you like us to call your lawyer? I remembered the screech of tires in my driveway, the front door swinging open. I had expected to see Lester first, but when I saw the colonel, his bald head silhouetted against the sunlight in the yard, I knew he was alone, and then I couldn't move, and his hands were around my neck, shaking me, my hair in my face, and I couldn't breathe, and a buzzing darkness was rising up inside my head. I nodded at the deputy. He handed me a small notepad and pen, and I wrote Connie Walsh's name and number. Then, what about Birani? What's he being charged with? The young deputy read my note, then showed it to the older one, who looked right at me. His eyes were green and full of something that made me look down at his arms, at the thick tufts of hair on them. Mr. Birani's deceased. I was lying down, and they were standing there, but the room felt so suddenly still and quiet, I started to feel too far away to see and hear what would come next. I took the pad from the young deputy. What? I wanted to ask about Lester. Why hadn't he come back? Then I thought if they were calling me a kidnapper, they had to be calling him one first. But I couldn't be sure, so I didn't write any more. They didn't answer me anyway. The older one seemed to be in charge. He stepped away from the bed and told me to get the facts from my lawyer. Then the younger one called Connie Walsh's office and explained where I was and what I was being charged with. I heard the crimes again, and except for brandishing a weapon, pulling Lester's pistol out of my bag at the gas station, I had a hard time matching up kidnapping and false imprisonment with me. The older deputy held the door open for the younger one. Then they were gone. There was another bed in my room, but it was empty with no sheets, just a white plastic mattress cover, a TV suspended in the corner of the ceiling, the dark screen watching me. The colonel was dead. On the serving table was a pitcher and a short stack of paper cups. I poured water into one and drank, each swallow a spiny sea urchin in my throat. My window shade was pulled, and I could hear the sounds of traffic nearby. I scooted to the side of the bed. I was dressed in a hospital johnny with nothing underneath. I moved to the window, but my legs felt shaky. I opened the shade. 10 feet down was a flat tar roof with big air conditioning or heating units on it. And on the other side was more building and windows. In one of them was the colored flickering of a TV. I couldn't see the sky, but the daylight was overcast. I wondered if it was morning or afternoon. My neck was stiff, and I could hardly look down or to the right and left. I remembered seeing the colonel's yellow teeth grinding together, the flare of his nostrils, feeling my feet lift off the ground. I got back into bed and lay down, but it suddenly felt like a dangerous place, as if the bed were 1,000 feet off the ground. And if I turned over too fast or even reached for water, it would tilt and fall to rocks below. If Birani was dead, I was sure Lester must have killed him. Less than an hour later, the deputies came back, told me I'd been classified a flight risk and was being transferred to San Mateo County Hospital. The older one rode in the back of the ambulance with me. He sat across from my gurney chewing gum, looking around at all the medical equipment. Sometimes his eyes would look into mine. The sky was growing dark as they wheeled me here, and at the elevator an older woman with too much blush on her cheeks held the doors for us, and she smiled down at me and said, "You're going to be just fine, dear. You'll see." There was a smear of lipstick on her front teeth, which were perfect and false, but I wanted to believe her. The older deputy stayed here in my room until the nurse left. Then he stood close to the bed and looked down at me like he was waiting for me to finish answering a question he'd never asked. I swallowed and had to close my eyes a minute. When I opened them, he was shaking his head like I'd disappointed him. Les Burden and I used to be partners before they divided us up into single units. He was sheriff material, but he's all through now. I hope you know that. They've got him in protective custody, but that won't last. They'll throw him to the hounds. He stepped back from the bed and moved to the door. There'll be a man outside till you're okay to leave. Then you're going right to holding in Redwood City. Think about that. He left, and I looked up at the white rectangles of the ceiling, the fluorescent light. I closed my eyes and swallowed what felt like a dozen thumbtacks, and I wanted that sandy-haired married deputy to feel it too, feel the colonel's thumbs breaking through his Adam's apple like it was cardboard. I wanted this old friend of Lester's to be at the fish camp when Lester put on his uniform and had me drive him to talk to the colonel. I wanted this friend to be in the house waking up to the whole family locked in the bathroom. And I wanted the deputy to be standing in the bedroom his father left him as Lester held his gun to the colonel's neck in my car. None of these things I asked for. I didn't ask for any of them. A nurse and doctor came into the room. The nurse was younger than me. She smiled and introduced the doctor, a short man with silver hair and thick glasses that made his eyes look tiny. He read the clipboard at the foot of the bed, then came closer and put two warm fingers against my throat. My eyes began to fill up, and I must have made a sound because the nurse took my hand and held it, while the doctor looked down my throat with a tiny flashlight, then patted my shoulder and said my soft tissue was healing well and it would be best not to speak a word for at least 2 full weeks. Then they were gone, their white coats disappearing behind the door, and I didn't feel mad anymore. Maybe I didn't deserve the deputy's judgment of me for things I never did, but now I felt even more that I didn't deserve the warmth the nurse just showed me, holding my hand like I was a victim in all this, because I knew that wasn't true. Neither picture of me was true. My door opened, and a round Chicano woman brought in my supper on a tray, a glass of water, a bowl of clear yellow broth, and a dish of vanilla pudding. She smiled at me, and I could see a gold cap on one of her front teeth. She left the room, and Connie Walsh stepped in. Her dark hair was shorter than when I last saw her, cut close to the sides of her head, which made her pretty face look older and a little harsh. On her feet were brand new running shoes, and I started to smile, but my face felt funny, my lips thick and twisted, and I couldn't look right at her. She didn't say anything, just stood there, and I felt her looking at me. She put her hand on my shoulder, pushed my food tray closer to me, and asked if I could sit up. I pressed the button, and once I was up, glanced at her, at her dark eyes that took me in with nothing but concern. I thought of Mrs. Birani, how she looked at me like that too, and I felt I was with an old friend, one I was going to let down if I hadn't already. Connie Walsh handed me a spoon. How much do you know? I shook my head and pointed to my throat. She apologized and waved her hand in front of her face, opened the briefcase in her lap, then handed me a yellow legal pad and a pen. I pushed my supper tray to the side and wrote, "They said Mr. Birani is dead. Where's Lester?" She read the note before I'd finished turning it to her and looked at me a second, her lips slightly pursed. I wrote, "What happened?" She took the pen and pad and began to write, then stopped and shook her head at what she'd just done. I smiled and she started to smile too. "Is Mr. Burden your boyfriend?" I nodded, and I wished I could hear my voice as I answered yes. "He's in custody in Redwood City." I looked at her and waited. Her eyes went to my supper. The boy was killed. My whole face felt squeezed, the air pulling back in my throat. Evidently, he'd gotten a hold of Mr. Burden's pistol on a busy street and was pointing it at him. Connie Walsh's voice was calm and controlled, but she was looking at me like she'd only begun. "He was shot by police officers." This boy who this morning was walking so tall and straight down the hall, his black hair still mussed from sleep. I reached for the paper and pen, my fingers hot and thick. I thought Mr. Birani was dead, the colonel. Connie Walsh looked at me like she'd been waiting for the conversation to reach this point, and now that it had, she wasn't quite ready for it. She was leaning away from me slightly, her hands on her knees. I nodded for her to talk, but even before she started to, I couldn't look directly at her anymore. I focused on her hands, on her knuckles. which were wider than her long, thin fingers. Her nails were short, some with tiny scratches on them, and for a second I saw her on her knees after work digging in a garden. But then she was telling me everything, her hands coming together, her fingers intertwined, Mr. and Mrs. Birani lying dead in my old bedroom, Connie Walsh's voice talking of detectives reconstructing the scene. They want to talk to you, Kathy. Now I looked at her, but it was like seeing someone through the wrong end of a telescope. She wasn't talking anymore. She seemed to be waiting for me to try and speak or write something, but her face was too far away to read, just an oval of flesh that was now asking me to write her everything, to write what the colonel did to me and when, to write how involved I'd been in holding this family against their will. Write me everything, Kathy. Write me the truth. The word was a black bat flittering between us. I looked down at my own hands, at the cleaning calluses on my palms. I saw again Mrs. Birani standing in her kitchen, pressing her hand to the side of her head. I thought of the pain she must have been in, and I hoped it wasn't the last thing she'd felt. Connie Walsh's voice was more relaxed now, and she was getting up, telling me she was late for an appointment but would be back tomorrow to read the facts. That's how she referred to what I would write. She touched my hand a second, then was gone. I drank a spoonful of broth. It seemed to bathe my throat on the way down, but I didn't drink any more. I imagined the Biranis laid out on a mortician's table, the colonel, his suffering wife, his loyal son. My stomach drew backwards inside me, and I sat up fast, my mouth filling with saliva. Connie Walsh's notepad and pen fell to the floor, and I left them there, moved to the chair by the window, and sat. I breathed long and deep through my nose and mouth till I didn't feel like I was going to throw up. Outside the window, the parking lot was dimly lit with only a few street lamps, and at the far corner, cars passed on the road, their headlights and red taillights visible. In the hallway outside my door was the soft squeak of nurses' shoe soles as they passed by, the metal wheel roll of a food cart or gurney, the talking and laughing of three women at the nurse's station, a woman's voice over an intercom calling a doctor to ICU, then more talking, an elevator door sliding open and closed, the flushing of a toilet in a room not far from mine, then someone humming, the flap of a wet mop hitting the floor, the humming of a man's voice, the tune unrecognizable, and I was unrecognizable. I could see my reflection in the window, a small shadowed face, hair flattened in the back. I looked like a sick child, but I felt dirty. My throat was dry and it was harder to swallow than ever, but I didn't care. I closed my eyes and tried to concentrate on the facts for Connie Walsh, but I kept thinking of Lester in protective custody, sitting alone in some cell separated from the rest of the prisoners because he's a cop. The kind they would never understand, a man who would avoid shooting an armed Filipino boy, the kind that had risked his job to try and get me back into my house. The mopping and humming had moved farther down the hallway, and I could hear the deputy on duty clear his throat, turn the pages of a magazine or newspaper. I got up and turned off the light switch near the door. The nurse's button glowed white at the head of my bed, and I made my way back to the chair at the window, the vinyl upholstery sticking to the backs of my bare legs, and I remembered Mrs. Birani bringing tea and kiwi fruit to her son's room for me, her brown eyes full of compassion as she looked down at my bruised arms, as if her husband doing that had been the only reason I showed up at her doorstep drunk with Lester's gun. But it was everything. It was talking to my brother, Frank, and hearing that same old patronizing tone. It was the Mexican boy flicking his tongue out at me, his eyes on my crotch like it was something he'd already seen 100 times before. It was wearing stolen clothes. It was the bright sun on the day after I had drunk too much with Lester the night before. It was my dry mouth and the deep hungover fear I had that Lester had used me up already and was going back to his wife. It was driving through his neighborhood of one-story ranch houses in the heat looking for what I hoped I wouldn't find. It was all these things and none of them. It was Lester pulling out of me at the fish camp, coming on to me in what I was sure was a sudden change of heart. It was me letting Lester finish what we'd both started, letting all this happen so I could put off facing my mother and brother with the news that somehow Dad's house had slipped through my fingers. I'd been willing for Lester to do anything so I could put off that moment of judgment. I looked out over the empty parking lot, at the shadowed wooden fence and the black trees behind it, and for a while I tried to tell myself it was the Colonel who had brought all this down on us. It was him not doing the right thing with my father's house. It was his greed and it was his pride. I remembered him on his new roof deck with his wife and daughter and friends, his expensive suit, a flute of champagne in his hand, potted flowers set in the corners of the railing and on the floor, laughing at something one of the fat rich women had said. The way he looked at me as we drove by, his eyes narrowed, all the muscles of his face still with some kind of concentration that scared me. The door behind me opened, and the light from the hall spread across the room. I didn't turn around, but in the window reflection I could see the deputy's silhouette, his short haircut and baggy short sleeves, his gun belt. He seemed to look from the chair to the bed, then at the chair again before he stepped back into the hallway, the heavy door closing by itself. My throat felt like cracked stone, and with each swallow my eyes would tear, but I didn't let myself get up for water or broth. I slept in my chair at the window. When I opened my eyes, the darkness was fading, and I watched the light come from the east, spreading over the stucco house and its yard, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. Now the little boy's mother drank her coffee and read her paper on the deck. She leaned forward as she read, her thick hair gathered over one shoulder. I wondered what her husband was like. Was he kind to her? Did he want a child when his wife got pregnant? Did they make love early in the morning before their son woke up? My throat hurt worse than ever. I went to the bathroom, and when I came out, the toilet still flushing, a new doctor and the deputy were standing at the foot of the bed waiting for me. The doctor was tall. He introduced himself, then had me sit on the bed, and he looked down my throat with his penlight, put his fingers on my lymph glands, and told me not to talk for 10 to 14 more days. The deputy's eyes were full of a light that reminded me of my brother, fascinated by other people's trouble. Happy he was in the clear. The doctor wrote something on the clipboard, then left, and the deputy handed me my old clothes, my shorts, the girl's fisherman's wharf t-shirt, her two small yellow panties. He told me I was being transferred to Redwood City to be booked. Then he left the room, and I changed at the window, my eyes on the boy and his mother. The underpants were still tight at my hips, and as I pulled on my shirt and shorts, the boy stood, his hands open at his sides. He climbed out of the sandbox and walked over the grass. He stepped onto the deck in front of his mother, then held his hands out in front of him, his chin pulled in slightly, his belly sticking out. His mother smiled down at him. She wiped the sand off his hands and lifted him onto her lap, his small back against her breasts, his sneakers just barely reaching her knees. The door opened behind me, but I didn't turn around, and I could smell the deputy's spearmint gum as he said he was sorry, but he had to follow procedure, and he took my wrists and slipped the cool metal of his handcuffs onto them, clicking them closed, my pulse pushing against them. I couldn't see the boy's face anymore, and in the hours and days that followed, I would think of him, the way an important dream comes back to you throughout the day, a day that begins at 6:30, my door unlocking electronically, me stepping out onto the second tier and filing downstairs with black women and white women, Chicanas, all of us dressed in the orange khaki pants and tank tops and overshirts of the San Mateo County Jail, over 50 of us. On the bottom tier, we sit at steel tables and eat toast and cold cereal or scrambled eggs and sausage links. two-color TVs are fixed to the wall, tuned to morning news shows, the anchor women pretty and successful. In the middle of the room is a control desk with four women deputies on duty, and on clear days, the door to the rec yard is open, though it's not a yard at all, but a flat rooftop with a universal weightlifting gym set in the middle of it, a piece of equipment no one uses. One morning, a young black girl pulled herself to the top of the chinning bar, sat there, and smoked two cigarettes. At the edge of the yard is a high hurricane fence topped with razor wire, then it's four stories down to the streets of Redwood City. You can see the old domed courthouse and part of the Hall of Justice building where Lester used to work. But of course, Lester is here with me now, somewhere under us in another wing with the men, the carjackers and rapists and murderers. On the bottom tier, after breakfast, most of the women stay at the tables and smoke and talk. There are payphones on the wall, which never go unused, women calling their kids and boyfriends, or husbands collect, their eyes miles away as they talk and sometimes yell or cry into the phone. Some even laugh, but I don't. I don't smoke either. My throat can't tolerate it, the smoke going down like grit rubbed into a raw scrape. There's a black woman named Jolene who smokes pack after pack of Marlboro Lights. Her voice is as deep as a man's. She's short with boyish hips and small breasts, and her knuckles are wide and hard-looking, and she never stops talking, and even the big women seem smaller around her. My first week, one afternoon before the midday lockdown for lunch cleanup, she tapped me on the shoulder and said, loud enough for an audience, "Why you here, girl?" I was sitting at a table with two Mexican girls who spent their lunch talking to each other in Spanish. Three or four black women were standing around and behind Jolene waiting for my answer. At first I didn't understand her question, and I couldn't talk anyway. I pointed to my throat and shook my head. "You can't talk?" I nodded. "You deaf?" I shook my head again. One of the women behind Jolene smiled, and I could see her teeth were bad. "So you's mute?" The one with the bad teeth laughed. A few others smiled. One of the deputies from the control panel called over to everybody to head back to their cells for lockdown. I nodded at Jolene, and she was smiling like I'd just shown her something she'd been wanting to know a long time. "You mean God sit back with the remote and motherfucking mute your ass?" Jolene's girls laughed and I smiled, and that afternoon after supper, while we all sat at tables in front of the two TVs on two different channels, waiting for our turn to go to the commissary or laundry exchange, Jolene yelled across the room at me, "Hey, remote, mute them motherfucking TVs!" She laughed louder than the women around her, and from then on, if a woman needed me to pass her the salt or hand off to somebody a lighter or cigarette, she'd say in a loud voice, "Send me the salt, remote," or, "Remote, pass this down to Big April." After the first 2 weeks, when I was alone in my cell, I tried talking again, naming the objects in front of me. Floor, wall, toilet, sink. My throat aching no more than when you have an allergy. My voice may be lower than it used to be, but I still kept quiet on the bottom tier and in the rec yard, and I let them call me by my new name. These first weeks, Connie has come and seen me three times, once with two detectives who took me to a room and had me write how the colonel tried to strangle me before he went on to do the rest. Lawyers and visitors have to go to the mezzanine on the second tier, a room of enclosed booths with thick glass separating us from visitors. Until I could use my voice again, Connie would talk into the phone while I wrote my answers and questions and held them up to the glass. Now that my voice is back, I hunch forward and talk softly into the receiver so none of the other inmates with visitors will notice. Every time, Connie wants to hear the facts. I tell her what I've done, wishing I hadn't said anything because her planned defense of me is that I was defenseless, suicidal, and drugged when Lester was locking the Biranis into their bathroom, that I was sick and physically weak, my judgment impaired, the next day when he forced the colonel and his son to Redwood City. She wants to argue that I am not who they're charging me as being, though she admits she has a mountain to climb to prove all this because my best witnesses are no longer with us. That's her expression. No longer with us. Though that doesn't seem true to me. Connie was able to get me some money for magazines at the commissary, but during the lockdown hours after our meals, I sit on my bunk and can't even look at them. Instead, I keep seeing Mrs. Birani, her small lined face, her deep brown eyes, the way she looked at me, one woman to another, when she asked if Lester would hurt her son, who I feel hovering in the corners of my cell, a young and polite presence. And I see his father in a way I never saw him, his bald head turned towards me, his face with no expression, like nothing I did to him can touch him now, but his eyes are two dark stars of grief. Sometimes I sit against the wall on the wreck roof with the sun on my face. I can hear the TVs inside, the chatter of the other women, one of them coughing. I look past the chain-link fence at the edge of the roof, the razor wire too bright, and I ache to see Lester, to lie beside him in the hot loft of the fish camp, to kiss his crooked mustache and hold his narrow back. I remember his ex-partner at the hospital saying he'll be thrown to the hounds, and I can only hope he's wrong, that the guards will look out for one of their own, though I feel like I'm lying to myself thinking this. I don't let myself think of his kids or his wife, and if I think of the house at all, it's only that I should have died there and nobody else, of how much better it would have been if Mr. Birani never saved me from Lester's gun, if Mrs. Birani never saved me from her own pills. Today, Jolene walks over to me, a cigarette smoking between her lips, her eyes squinting like a man's. Mezzanine bitch sent me to get you. You got visitors. I'm so surprised to hear this, I almost ask out loud who. But instead, I keep my eyes on Jolene, waiting for her to say more. That's right, remote. Somebody wants to do sign language. Only 2 days before, I saw Connie. She's still working on getting my hearing date moved up. I told her I didn't want her to make me look like I wasn't responsible for what Lester had done. But you weren't, Kathy. We're not fabricating any of that. Connie looked at me through the glass, the phone pressed to her ear. I could see small red marks on both sides of her nose from reading glasses or sunglasses. She looked tired, her lips parted, ready to argue against whatever I was about to say. The other visiting cubicles were empty, but I kept my voice to a whisper as I talked into the phone. I'll deny it. I'll say I was sober and never took any pills. Connie Walsh shook her head, her lips pressing tightly together. Then what is our defense, Kathy? I don't have one. A family is gone. My throat started to close up and I turned my face away. I put the receiver back on the hook, left the mezzanine, and went back out to the tier where I knew I wouldn't cry, where I was relieved I didn't have a voice. Now I climb the concrete steps to the second tier, thinking it is either Connie or she's dropped me as her client and it'll be a new lawyer, one assigned by the state. A blonde deputy opens the door for me. Whoever has come is sitting, and I'm not close enough to see who through the glass over the cubicles, one of them taken up by a Chicana girl, her husband or boyfriend on the other side holding the phone to a little girl's ear. Then, behind the glass, a few cubicles down, my brother, Frank, stands up. He's wearing a banana yellow polo shirt. His black hair is moosed back, and there's a thin gold chain around his neck, a gold watch band on his wrist. He's gained weight, the curve of his belly pushing his belt buckle a little. He's squinting into the glass, his hands on his hips, but he doesn't see me. Then he does, and his lips part. His eyes get shiny, and I want to turn and walk back out onto the tier. I hadn't sent a letter. I hadn't made one phone call. I guess I was waiting for Labor Day to come and go. For my mother and aunts to drive by the empty house and know Frank had been right, that I was away on a trip and wouldn't be back for a long time. Frankie begins to blur. I wipe my eyes, step into the phone stall, and there's my mother sitting in the chair looking up at me like I'm a vision she's been both praying and dreading would come. She's wearing too much makeup, the blush too pink and high on her cheeks, her lipstick too red. She's wearing her costume pearls and a purple and blue flowered dress. And she's just had her hair done. From where I stand, my breath high in my throat, I can see a round spot of scalp through her thinning hair. There are old lady tendons in her throat. Frank picks up the receiver and starts to say something, but then stops and waits for me to raise mine. I stay standing and hold the receiver, light as balsa wood, to my ear. "Why didn't you call us, Calf?" I glance down at my mother. She's looking up at me through the glass, her eyes slightly bloodshot. I swallow and point to my throat, and I'm about to say I couldn't call at the time, but Frank interrupts me. "You can't talk?" I don't answer, but feel myself slide back into the lie like a warm bath. My mother turns and asks him for the phone. "Kay, are you all right? Your aunts and I drove by the house yesterday, and there was that police tape over the doors and windows. Why can't you talk? Frankie flew out this morning. It took us all day to find you. No one would tell us anything, Kay. Honey, are you all right?" My mother was squinting into the glass like I was a ghost that might fade away any second. And that's how I felt. Dead to them. Nothing but a voice from the other side. I started to feel strangely at ease. Safely out of their reach in every way. My mother's lower lip starts to quiver. Her eyes go from mine to my county jail orange, then back to my face. And I want to stand and show her all of it. The whole costume. Every piece of it, right down to the orange underwear that's as big and loose as a man's. I lean close to the glass and speak into the phone. "I'm all right, Mother. I have never called her that, only Mom or Ma. But I like the sound of Mother, the dignity it seems to give her, the bereaved." "Kay, what happened?" She starts to cry. Frankie puts his hand on her shoulder and hands her his monogrammed handkerchief. I look up at his face through the glass, but he isn't looking at me. His eyes are on the countertop, and he seems about to go off into a stare, like he'd just as soon sit this moment out somewhere else. But also there's hurt in his face, and for a second I wonder about Jeannie and the kids. Is everything all right at home? I must have asked this into the phone, and the question props my mother up instantly. "Of course they're not all right. They're worried sick about you. What have you done, Kay? Why are you here?" My mother still looks like she's going to cry, but there's something hard on her face now. She dabs at her mascara, her lips pressed together, bracing herself for what I'm going to tell her. She's waiting for the facts. But her last question is still a wire of words in my head that won't stop vibrating, that's been singing the same thing for years and years. "What have you done? Why are you here?" My mother is talking into the phone again, asking me about Dad's house, about the police tape across the front door, about the widow's walk Frank had never given permission to build. "Can't you speak, Kay? Is there something wrong with your voice? Did Nick have anything to do with this?" Frankie is looking down at me through the glass. He shrugs as if he's not quite sure he was supposed to have mentioned that, but did. I look back at my mother, her eyes waiting, always waiting. Her last question seems as ridiculous and naive as can be. "Nick left me, Mom." "But why?" "I don't know why, Ma. Why don't you go find him and ask him?" My mother's eyes turn hard now. Her question might have sounded different coming from somebody else, more gentle, like the man who left me must have been in the dark about my best qualities. but from her it was an interrogation. What did you do this time, Kathy? How could you have let him go? But now she looks confused. Her two red lips parted, her forehead furrowed. She shakes her head once, the way the hard of hearing do. A second ago, I'd felt like hitting her over the head with the truth of my story, telling her the charges against me, telling her about the Biranis, holding her face in everything. But she looks so vulnerable right now, so pathetic in her pearls and dress and makeup, trying to make a good impression on my jailers. I can't say more. I shake my head and point to my throat. I had an operation. I shouldn't talk right now. Call this number. I write Connie Walsh's telephone number on the memo pad they leave in each cubicle for us, my shoulder squeezing the phone to my ear, and I hold the pad to the glass. My mother is quiet on the other end, and this should be familiar to me, her silence as I keep the truth from her. Frank is punching the number into the computerized Rolodex on his watch, and I'm looking into my mother's eyes as dark as they've always been, tiny pink capillaries broken in the whites, but now they don't look cold or hard, though not warm either. Under her eyes is a small packet of flesh her pancake foundation can't hide. She raises her chin, her red lips pressing together, and I am the hunter who has caught an old deer in his range only to lower my bow. And this wall of safety glass between us doesn't feel like a bad thing, more like something natural, inevitable. Her eyes stay on mine longer than I can ever remember. I can look at her for days. Then she blinks, stands quickly, and turns to go as if I've already left. I wave at Frankie, but he is hanging up the receiver, and I don't wait for him to look up. I walk past the cubicles and out onto the second tier. I can hear the TVs and the chatter and Jolene's hoarse laugh coming from below. I see her sitting at one of the tables playing cards, blackjack, it looks like, and she's the dealer. The table is full of her women, all black except for a new blonde girl who is sitting quietly between Jolene and Big April, an obese woman whose chins sag to her cleavage. I stop on the stairs and watch Jolene take Big April's money, a small mound of pieces of notepad paper. The air is heavy with cigarette smoke, and the sunlight from the open rec door makes it look heavier than it is, bluish, a wide band of it hovering over everyone's heads. I think of Lester, his Toyota station wagon pulling away from the neon light of the El Rancho Motel, disappearing into the fog. There is a loosening warmth between my legs, and I want to feel him inside me again, but feel sure now I never will. Behind and above me, the deputy tells me to move along, no loitering on the stairs, and Jolene looks up and laughs. Get down here, remote! And I smile at her and nod like she's just said something I never understood before, but now finally do. I descend the stairs, my eyes on the wide, flat cloud as I walk down under it, this blue ceiling of smoke we make. And I feel it above me as I move past the women at the phones, past other women at other tables, all of them smoking, blowing out thin, angry streams into the air. And I stand at Jolene's shoulder. She stops dealing and looks up at me, her dark eyes waiting, though she's never heard me speak. And I nod at her pack of Marlboro lights. At first, she doesn't seem to understand what I want, but then I smile and put two fingers to my lips.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.